morning. I'm so glad to see y'all here today. It's, hope everyone had a good evening last night and enjoyed their quail. I certainly did.
Thank you, John and Charles. I'm not in very good voice today, so I hope you'll be able to hear me. Before I launch into my dry historical talk, I thought I would talk a little bit about food. When John T. first asked me to speak, I told him I didn't know anything about food except the eating of it, but he told me he wanted me to talk about farming. We've often heard the expression that you are what you eat. While this is a problematical notion, just as suggesting that owners resemble their dogs, I've spent several entertaining meals with my younger daughter, Laura, at Bill's Barbecue in Wilson, North Carolina, studying this very thing. Bill Ellis has one of those Eastern North Carolina vinegar, red pepper, salt barbecue saloons. And on the walls are pictures of stock cars, which he sponsors. If you go there looking for inattentive French waiters, you're at the wrong place. Bill hires high school boys who do wind sprints between the table and the kitchen. Waiter in Bill's firm is an oxymoron. These waiters catch you just before you settle down in your chair, ask what you want, and if you require a menu, which they frown on, you're supposed to know. And they take your order while they're sitting down a pitcher of sweetened iced tea. I don't think there's any option. And you order by just saying something like Q platter, Q sandwich, whatever. You're supposed to know what you want. And with that information, the kid breaks for the kitchen. And, of course, the kitchen is not technically correct because they prepare the barbecue outside over a pit. But the kitchen is an assembly point where they have the potatoes and the Brunswick stew and the barbecue and the hush puppies and so forth. So as Laura and I attempt to finish the first paragraph of our conversation, here comes the kid sprinting back with the food. But we will not be rushed in our appraisal of our gorging customers who are surrounding us. Invariably, Laura and I spot these porcine customers. Ample men and women, jawed, jolly, enthusiastically forking in the barbecue. And we've learned, I've talked to her on the phone about this a few days ago, we've learned to communicate by nods, you know, eye contact, because we don't want to point out our little game to everybody. In all fairness, there could be people who look like hogs in every restaurant in eastern North Carolina, and we would... We would be the first to admit that our sample likes scientific rigor. In an earlier draft of this paper, I toyed around with the steak crowd that I've observed occasionally in Washington, especially those bovine-headed, sag-jawed Cadillac drivers who always seem to sit about 4 feet from the steering wheel so their girth can be contained. But I decided I wouldn't go into that anymore. So what comes to mind when you hear Southern Farm? Is it Jamestown and tobacco, or South Carolina and Georgia and rice, or Louisiana and sugar, or Mississippi and cotton? And what comes to mind when you hear Southern farmer? Is it the fabled yeoman? Is it an indentured servant, a slave, a sharecropper, a planter? Or farmhouse? Is it Monticello? Is it Tara? Or is it a shotgun house? Or a dog trot. Where in these images does one find a stable idea of a Southern farm? Where do we find the reality? Many Americans have a vague notion of Thomas Jefferson's idealized, noble, chosen, self-sufficient yeoman farmer. We know of the antebellum plantation. We've heard of piney wood cracker shacks, of red-necked hill farms. At more recent times, the big house, the middle house, and the shack. So what does one make of all this diversity? One could make an exhibit. For 20 years since I arrived at the National Museum of American History, I've been trying with no effect to convince Smithsonian leaders and possible funders that Southern farmers represent an epic story, this broad, engaging, and significant moment in American history. In my research, writing, and collecting for the museum were aimed at an exhibit on Southern farming that would span roughly the founding of the country up to the present. I should explain that our present agriculture hall was put in the mid-60s when the museum opened, and it's just an assemblage of machines with no relation to any crop or any people who might have ever operated them. It's very out of date and is a disgrace in many ways. In one of the fundraising attempts some 10 years ago, we made an enthusiastic presentation to one of America's largest implement manufacturers, and we thought that we were on the way to getting funding for this exhibit, and we were out at their headquarters in the Midwest, and I had told them pretty much this enthusiastic story, and after we finished, he said that at the present time they didn't have the funding, the usual letdown, and then he looked at me and he said, "Why don't you do wheat?" And I stifled back the two-word response that I really wanted to say. And I just said, "It's been done." On another occasion, three gentlemen from agribusiness called at our development office, and I went over and listened to them. And they wanted to, and this is the word, tell the story of American agriculture. Now, what does that mean? It means they want this success story that's all about gleaming machines and great petrochemicals, I mean, the chemicals that we use for farming, and a great success story. And they didn't want to hear anything about history. A Midwestern congresswoman came by, all enthusiastic about telling the story of American agriculture. A nice gentleman from the Farm Bureau came by wanting to tell the story of American agriculture. But because I was the person that was the agricultural curator, I held out for doing nothing except the Southern story. A story that's never going to be done because I'm retiring in 2 years and they still haven't raised any money. And when I'm gone, they can do wheat. See, they were bothered because the South has a troublesome history. That is, we're not perfect like people in the Midwest. And our imperfections are what make us so interesting and what makes our food interesting and makes studying Southern history something that I just love and can't get enough of. I'm addicted to it. And part of the problem with Southern farming that tainted it in the eyes of so many other Americans, besides the slavery, sharecropping, and exploitation, even worse, we clung to labor-intensive ways long after the Midwest had fully mechanized. We were behind. We weren't pulling our fair share of consumerism in the agricultural sector. It was only during the New Deal that Henry A. Wallace and his Midwestern staff drew up the Iowa Blueprint for all America. In a sense, the history of Southern agriculture from 1933 to the present consists of forcing shacks, barns, crossroads stores, mules, woods, streams, small farms, sharecroppers, tenants, and blacks and whites into a blueprint, the Iowa blueprint of these large sections, mile square of land that are the same. You have machines and nice houses and all. This was the vision. And its success can be measured, as I did yesterday, by driving through the Delta. What's the difference between the Delta and Iowa? Well, between Iowa and the Central Valley. America has turned to this big agricultural production now, and we have buckled under to the Iowa blueprint. And, of course, when you look at the South in 1933 and compare it to today, it's obvious that to achieve this, the patient had to have some amputations and plastic surgery to recreate the Delta in the image of Iowa. This was not painless. Today I want to focus on three topics that go to the idea and reality of the Southern farm. First, by looking at labor laws and peonage, I want to explore the terrible reality of the poorest Southerners. Second, with some memories augmented by research, I want to look a little closer at the Iowa Plan. And finally, by looking at the spread of synthetic chemicals after World War II, I'll raise some questions about the environment. The creation of agribusiness is part of a continuum that dates back to the Reconstruction years. In the years between 1865 and 1933, a complex set of state laws defined the relations between landlord and tenant. Many of the Reconstruction labor contracts with former slaves, as well as the intended black codes, demonstrated how much landlords wanted to preserve every element of slavery that they could, by directing the work, restricting travel, and controlling family life. The emancipation idea of 40 acres and a mule contained an understanding of what it took to be an independent farmer. But Reconstruction revolved not around land and mule ownership for former slaves, but rather around who controlled the sale of the crop and ultimately over labor control. If former slaves owned the land they tilled, they would control their own labor and the fruits of that labor. The struggle over these issues persisted from the end of the Civil War to the New Deal. Over those years, many former slaves bought land, but many whites and blacks became indebted, lost their land, and ended up as sharecroppers or even peons. Reality for those at the very bottom of the farming heap meant peonage. As an Alabama U.S. attorney explained at the turn of the century, in his words, the tendency of the legislative enactments of this state since the Reconstruction period has been uniformly to weave about the ignorant laborer, and especially the blacks, a system of laws intended to keep him absolutely dependent upon the will of the employer and the landowner. In 1885, Alabama passed what was called a false pretenses law. If a laborer signed a contract, obtained the customary advance in money, intending fraud, and then left his job without repaying the money, he should be punished as if he'd stolen it. Of course, it was difficult to prove intent. In 1903, the Alabama legislature amended the false pretenses law by adding that the laborer taking the money and failing to pay it back or work it out shall be prima facie evidence of intent to injure and defraud his employer. So just taking the money and leaving was the crime. And then they passed a rule of evidence that the person who left couldn't testify as to what his intent in leaving was. This simply means, explained Booker T. Washington at Tuskegee Institute, that any white man who cares to charge that a colored man has promised to work for him and has not done so, or who has gotten money from him and not paid it back, can have the colored man sent to the chain gang. Washington secretly backed the Alonzo Bailey case that twice went to the U.S. Supreme Court, which in 1911 struck down the Alabama false pretenses laws. 3 years later, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in U.S. v. Reynolds that the criminal surety system violated the peonage statute. This should have ended the custom of planters who would go to the jail and bail out the people there and carry them back to their farms and work them far beyond what they were supposed to and force them to work out the debt. But customs die hard. The most egregious abuse of the criminal surety laws happened after World War I. John S. Williams and his sons bailed out black prisoners and worked them on a Georgia farm. He re-imprisoned these men, guarded them with guns, chased them with bloodhounds, and beat recalcitrant workers. Still, two men escaped and contacted federal agents, and on February 18, 1921, two agents went to the John S. Williams farm and discovered, indeed, that the men slept in barracks that were locked. They were guarded with men with guns. and they were forbidden to leave. When John Williams drove up, the agents got there, before, he was not on the plantation. When he drove up, the workers were mute while the agents discussed this with John Williams. And he allowed us to howl that he may have broken the law because everybody in the community did this and it was just the custom. But he said he would do better. And the agents left. And John Williams considered the gravity of federal charges. And then he had a meeting with his adult sons and they left the farm. And then he had a meeting with his black foreman, Clyde Manning. And he said, "Clyde, we're going to have to do away with these boys, and I want you to help." And he made it clear that if Manning didn't help him, that he would be killed. The reality of the Southern farm can be found in the transcripts of the Williams and Manning murder cases. And I'll just give you one little sample. After dinner one night when this started, five black workers and John S. Williams got into his car. A few miles down the road, Williams pulled over, and with the help of Manning and another trustee, Charlie Chisholm, they bound three of the men with trace chains and hung 100-pound sacks filled with rocks around their neck. This is what Manning's testified. Lindsey Peterson and Will Preston, they didn't think we were going to do anything to them until we got to the river. There, with Williams giving the order, Charlie Chisholm and Manning lifted the two men to the railing of the bridge. Manning again. And they were scuffling and trying to keep back, to keep from going over. And he told us to push them over. And we throw them over. And then we got in the car and left there. Williams drove several miles down the road to another bridge. Harry Price, the third of the peons, who left the Williams plantation in the car, pled with Manning, "Don't throw me over. I will get over." Manning recalled that Price crawled up on the banister, sat up on the banister. He sat there just a little while, and he says, "Don't throw me." He says, "Lord, have mercy," and went right on over. At least eight other men were killed. Several disappeared without a trace and were presumed dead. There were no witnesses left then to testify to federal penance charges. And had not the river fallen and exposed some of the bodies, Williams may indeed have gotten away with murder. A jury found both Williams and Manning guilty of first-degree murder. No penance charges were ever filed against Williams' sons or against Williams. So sometimes the reality of the Southern farm bleeds right off the page. It's so awesome. John T. didn't tell you that I wrote a book on peonage. A decade after the Williams case, low commodity prices became the reality of Southern farmers. After 3 years of formal depression heaped on what had been misery most years since World War I, Southern farmers were in desperate circumstances. When I started out as a historian, it seemed to me that the New Deal was a success. It cut acreage, raised prices, and seemed to stabilize production. Later, when I studied more intensely and looked at the whole South, my thinking took another direction. Whatever his intention, Secretary of Agriculture Henry A. Wallace created the bureaucratic infrastructure of agribusiness. His Iowa blueprint depended on local agricultural adjustment administration committees who were composed of the elite farmers in each county to allot the acreage and settle some of the labor disputes. As some of you understand, the allotment process. How many in here, let's say a show of hands, how many understand what an allotment is? It simply means when the New Deal started, if you were a tobacco farmer and grew 15 acres of tobacco annually, that was your base allotment. And from that, they started cutting year after year to keep production down. It's in 1934, they cut like 20%. and so forth. Every year, the allotment seemed to shrink. And farmers offset this to some extent by increasing fertilization, more intense cultivation. But of course, the U.S. Department of Agriculture had one set of scientific bureaucrats studying how to grow more tobacco per acre, and they had another set of bureaucrats telling you you couldn't grow as much, which is typical. Is anybody here who understands U.S. agricultural policy? I would like to see your hand and have an extended conversation with you after this is over. All this was justified by one of the greatest cliches that has ever been invented. America was feeding a starving world. When, of course, we couldn't sell what we grew. But that was and still is, the cliche that everybody falls back on. As a kid, I encountered this program through my maternal grandparents who farmed near Seven Paths in North Carolina. And following Charles's great example, I'll give a little autobiographical part here. The farmhouse sat off the dirt road about 100 yards in a grove. There were three tobacco barns, a pack house, another barn, an outhouse, and an open well. As near as I can recall, my grandfather, Calvin Hunt, had about 10 acres of tobacco allotment. When I was about 13 years old, I rode my bicycle out there for the summer, and it's about 7 miles, and spent the summer barning tobacco. I'd done it a lot earlier, but this was a full-time summer job. Somewhere deep in my memory are smells, tastes, and images that come from that time, especially from my grandmother Annie Hunt's kitchen. In the morning before light, she cooked biscuits in a wood-burning range. None of her daughters would remember the recipe. It was dabs and so forth, with nothing written down. There was also king syrup, eggs, bacon, or sausage, and for me, diluted coffee. My grandmother reasoned that drinking coffee would make you ugly. The pre-light smells and tastes of those days are deeply imprinted in my mind. It was only later that it occurred to me that my grandmother had risen hours before we sat down for breakfast, that she'd built the fire, whipped up the biscuit dough, cooked the breakfast, and was facing milking the cow after she washed the dishes. My grandfather wouldn't milk a cow. Later, my grandmother would help at the scaffold, doing the barning tobacco part, then cook dinner over the wood stove, clean up the kitchen, go back to the scaffold, and then cook supper and clean up again. Over time, they ran electric lines out to Franklin County and paved the road. So running water followed, but my grandmother always looked awkward in front of an electric stove. She was the master of the wood stove. My grandfather was preoccupied with how he could continue farming tobacco with his ever-disappearing allotment. He swapped help with neighbors and did what he could to survive. Our week was made up pretty much of barning for one person. We'd go down the road and trade off help with somebody else who'd helped us, and then I think we were trading with three people that summer. And, of course, that doesn't involve any cash, just trading help. All these farmers were just hanging on. Across the road, one of the great curiosities, Mr. Jones farmed with an ox, which we always were mystified by. Of course, trying to mechanize and gain any advantage on this scale was ridiculous. It was just too small. At some point, my grandfather reluctantly installed oil burners in his barns because the usual custom was in the winter you'd chop trees down and cut up the wood and put it away for using in the barns in the summertime. Finally, my Uncle Keo, who was a World War II veteran, but still the baby of the family, bought a used farm-all tractor, and that turned him into a Luddite straight away. He cursed that tractor, not as bad as he cursed the mules, but he turned into a Luddite and left very soon for Norfolk to drive a Gulf Oil truck for the rest of his driving career. And he still tends a garden in Norfolk that's the envy of his neighbors, and he raises orchids, so he has the green thumb. But when I talked to Uncle Keo and Aunt Nadine, who both grew up there, there's no nostalgia for going back to farming. What I did not know as a kid was that the acreage allotments were not necessarily reduced on a just scale. Years later in the National Archives, I went through box after box of complaints complaining of favoritism in handing out allotments to family and friends of committee men, to people who worked in the office, to the big farmers. Even if the acreage were handed out equitably, small farmers saw their allotments dwindle to the point where after a while they couldn't farm anymore. So some of these letters give insight into the reality of how Southern farmers in the 1950s saw their life. A Kentucky tobacco farmer judged that the Adair County agent had been replaced by, in his words, a much bigger crook. The county committee, he added, had favored certain farmers, and the situation was so rotten it stinks. Another farmer became so disgusted with the county office that he quit farming and found a job in Louisville, 100 miles from his family. Many Southern farmers suspected that county committees played favorites when allotting acreage. In 1954, a South Carolina farmer complained that the county agricultural committee was corrupt. He wanted to review their files. He wrote several letters demanding that he be able to review the files because he thought that the office staff and the relatives and all these people were getting too many acres. Farmers often faced unresponsive, condescending, and inept bureaucrats. In 1954, Mrs. Clyde V. Collier explained to the head of the Rogersville, Tennessee Agriculture Office that incorrect reporting canceled her 7/10 of an acre tobacco allotment. She dutifully produced her 1948 production records, proving the agent's mistake. But, she complained, he said there was nothing that he could do about it, so I left there with nothing settled. Mrs. E.C. Odom, writing from Center, Mississippi in February 1954, complained that her cotton allotment had been cut from 14 acres to 7.8. How was she supposed to send four children to school, she inquired of Congressman Tom Abernathy. Why can't Secretary Benson, that's Ezra Taft Benson, give the hill farmers a break? When she went to the AAA office, she continued, they give you a harsh answer. She was weary of incompetence. Has America gone communist, she asked, for officials told her to every question there was nothing to be done about nothing. I should mention on a side, Ezra Taft Benson was a despised Secretary of Agriculture among Southerners. He did not understand anything about Southern agriculture, and especially he didn't understand anything about African Americans and Southern agriculture. And I had written a fairly incisive description of him that was purged from my book because it was largely relevant to my argument, but I just wanted to get a lick in at him. 4 years after Mrs. Odom's comments, Mary E. Putt from near Tupelo summed up her 3 year sharecropping. Her production went from 14 and a half bales of cotton down to 12, then during a rainy year to 4.5. Then the landlord put the land in the soil bank, took it out of production. And she was inquiring basically whether she could get some money for what was put in the soil bank. She explained what leaving the farm would mean to her family. It is against my will to rear children up in idleness, she wrote. By farming, I can be with them to instruct them as boys of their age need to be. It is one way to curb juvenile delinquency. She admitted that her children sometimes went to school without lunches, with poor clothing. Still, they'd only missed a few days because of sickness. Such was the life of the last generation of sharecroppers. During the early New Deal years, when federal intrusion arrived in force, people expressed hope that the government program would aid them. By the 1950s, bitter farmers condemned the very programs that earlier seemed their salvation. Mrs. J.O. Lawson from Covington, Georgia, dreamed of owning a farm and achieving security in her old age. In 1953, her husband, she said, taken a public job, and they left the farm. We have nothing after 28 years of married life and working hard to raise 8 children the right American decent way to live, she complained to Secretary Benson. Why do big men like you sit around and study up something to hurt a poor mule farmer? Henry J. Smith began his letter, "I'm not a farmer, just a soil slave." The Woodland, Mississippi farmer owned 45 acres, but he charged, "It was the big farmers who received favorable treatment." If I'm not wrong, the way I see the one gala soil tiller, if there isn't something done for him in the near future, there soon won't be any of us left on the farm. Many Southern farmers scorned policies that favored larger operators. El Campo, Texas farmer Norman L. Hicks declared in 1955, "The big rich are getting bigger. The poor little farmer is getting smaller." W.N. Andrews from Fort Payne, Alabama agreed. "You stick with the wealthy farmers," he complained to Secretary Benson. "You've been in there 3 years," he wrote in 1956, "and you haven't done one thing for little farmers." Many of his neighbors had left farming, he added. "I am 46 years of age, and all the record that I know of them having is to make the rich richer and the poor poorer." All around him, he said, bankers, merchants, lawyers, doctors, and politicians were farming for tax loss, weren't even farming to make a living. After calling on Benson to resign, Andrews wrote, "I'm sorry for you, and may God have mercy on you and forgive you." And he closed his letter, "One of the many deprived and mistreated farmers." So the Iowa plan was working. By the late 1950s, some farmers, adept at manipulating government programs, lived better than ever. Few farmers ever wrote of good times. I don't remember a letter, except the one I'm going to quote from now, where farmers would actually say, "I had a really good year. I made a lot of money." Have you ever heard that? It's not a commonly heard expression. But this man, C.P. Quincy, concluded in March 1958, "I consider the condition of the farmer during this period has grown from rags to riches." He had for 40 years run a general merchandise store in Hertford, North Carolina. Farmers, he said, owned tractors, combines, and trucks. But, he remarked, "they are never satisfied. Their hands are outstretched for a give me." The Department of Agriculture, in his opinion, was a laughingstock for millions of farmers because of the handouts they received without effort on their part. "Farmers work less than ever," he said. "Our farmers have become such sportsmen," he went on, "that there's not enough fishing piers on the North Carolina coast to accommodate the farmers that visit them daily." I never recall my grandfather Hunt ever going fishing. He did go each morning to Avery Stallings Crossroads store and have a Coca-Cola and a BC powder, which some people claim has a high connected to it, but I was satisfied with a Coca-Cola and peanuts. When he came to tobacco farming, he was very proud of his crop. And, of course, tobacco, flue-cured tobacco, where I grew up, was called a 13-month crop. You set out your plant bed in the wintertime, and then you prepared your land, you transplanted it, and you hoed it, and you cultivated it with a plow, and you wormed it, and you topped it, and did all manner of things to it. And then when it started getting ripe, you started at the bottom of the stalk and primed off the 3-4 leaves that were ripe week after week till you got to the tips. And I won't go through the whole process, but it was a back-breaking process. But my grandfather, at the end of that process, when you graded each leaf and tied it in hands, when he took it to the market, he was extremely proud of his presentation and that he was a tobacco farmer. But of course, he didn't get a whole lot of money for all that work, a pittance, actually. And this came home to me about 5 or 6 years ago when I interviewed for a job at Duke University and realized as I talked to the people at Duke that as part of my package that there would have to be reparation payments because my grandfather had been exploited all those years. And those payments should come to me. but they didn't even make a good enough offer for me to bargain with them with. There were other things going on that were invisible to me and to most farmers. As Rachel Carson observed about the 1950s, Americans were under invisible radiation from atomic tests, and we couldn't see actually the chemical poisons that were surrounding us. Not only were these agents invisible, no one knew the danger level of low-level radiation. And we didn't know what the danger level to pesticides were. And although people seemed immune to these chemicals, fish and wildlife paid an enormous price. Again, doing this research in the archives, you run across all kinds of commentary that take you right back to the location. In 1960, a man named S.L. Dewey wrote from New Orleans complaining about Endrin application in cane fields. Endrin was one of the most toxic chemicals that was used in agriculture at this time. When he was fishing in Assumption Parish, he saw a plane spraying Endrin and the surrounding cane fields. The next morning, he said, "When I went to go fishing, all the fish in this canal were dead, floating belly up. Endrin," he added, "fell on houses and was later washed off into cisterns, and it made the people sick." A farmer from Franklin, Louisiana, reported that Endrin killed, in his words, "all forms of wildlife that I know of. When a heavy rain comes any time after the spray is applied," he continued, "our streams are polluted and millions of fish are destroyed by suffocation from this poison." The local electric company, he went on, had to hire a man, in his words, to keep the dead fish away from the water pump screen in the Charenton Canal. In November 1963, there was a massive fish kill, some estimated 5 million fish, along the Mississippi River in Louisiana. The dead fish clogged the intakes to power plants and foul drinking water. It took 5 months to trace it back to its source, which was was Endrin again, traced to a Memphis plant, the Velsicol plant in Memphis. And then back to tobacco, as tobacco became more associated with health risks, the government scientists and tobacco company executives became vigilant in anticipating some of these problems. In 1967, 5 years after these massive fish kills along the Mississippi River, Germany was considering ruling that tobacco be treated as a food crop. The Department of Agriculture's Agricultural Research Service, the ARS, was concerned that no residue research had been done on tobacco. That is, if it wasn't a food, it could contain anything, even though you were ingesting it directly into your lungs. As an ARS deputy said, several years ago, the department canceled the registration of Endrin on tobacco. This was done with the concurrence of Shell, but I believe this was mainly an exercise, as Endrin is still used on tobacco. At about the same time, another ARS executive summarized research showing that feeding dogs even 0.1% per million, parts per million, of Endrin, in his words, produced slight kidney degeneration. And the effects were worse as you increased the dosage. The committee, the internal memorandum concluded, recommended that a tolerance for Endrin be denied because they could not find a clear demonstration of a no effect level. A few months later, the ARS admitted, "We have concern for the health of persons manufacturing the product and for those applying the pesticide chemical to the tobacco plants and to the person using the tobacco plants." And I was sharing with one of my Eastern North Carolina friends last night a peculiar malady of, what do you call it, Carol? Tobacco poisoning. When they were using these chemicals and you were out in the field, especially if it was wet, you'd work a part of a day and you'd be nauseous. (Clears throat) Engine residues also presented problems with soybeans and cottonseed oil, for the chemical ended up in vegetable oil. The problem with residues in oil crops would continue, an ARS scientist predicted, until these particular pesticides were discontinued. And he went on, if the FDA were to enforce present regulations, there would be practically no southern soybeans processed. The short-term effects of some chemicals seem benign, at least to humans, but the long-term effects would only emerge in time. Indeed, scientists are still debating the question. That is why the case Lawler v. Skelton is so important. On the morning of August 16, 1956, the people around the Marie Gin and cotton fields that surrounded it were routinely going about their work. V.A. Johnson owned the gin and the surrounding fields near Indianola, Mississippi. Johnson's tenant, W.T. Skelton, had found a few signs of boll weevils, so he decided to spray. Johnny Martin, a pilot for the Turk Dusting Company, was on the last of three flights when he cut his engine and drifted toward the gin buildings that bordered the edge of the field. Below the plane, 50-year-old Charles Lawler was intent on welding some beams on a concrete slab right beside the cotton field. His helper, Johnny B. McCallum, shouted that the plane was coming and stepped under the gin overhang. There was a shed nearby. But before Lawler could move, a cloud of Endrin and Malathion enveloped him. And he was down on his knees with a welder's mask on, and the chemicals came over him, and he immediately started choking and couldn't get his breath. And McCallum came to his rescue and helped him get the mask off and rub some of the residue off of his face. But he immediately kept coughing and couldn't get his breath and finally became nauseous and went home and was running a high fever and was dizzy. He went back to the gin a few times but couldn't really do any work. And finally, he went home for the evening and was very ill during the night, and the next morning went into a coma. Nearly 4 years later, the director of the Entomology Research Division of the Agricultural Research Service pondered a telegram from the head of the Delta Council. Charles E. Lawler had brought a $150,000 lawsuit against the landlord, tenant, and aerial applicator, in the words of the telegram, as the result of the application of a Malathion engine mixture for the control of cotton insects. Lawler's health had deteriorated quickly after his encounter with the pesticide. The Delta Council suggested that an entomologist at the Delta Branch Station in Stoneville, Mississippi, and he was also a Shell consultant, testify as an expert witness in the trial. Such testimony could be vital, the Delta Council telegram suggested, and the case, in the words of the telegram, could have influence on cotton insect control program in future years. An ARS staff member stressed, in his words, the importance of this suit and the effect it could have on cotton insect and other insect control programs if the claim for damage is sustained, even though, he quickly added, there is every indication that the insecticide was not responsible for the plaintiff's illness. Faced with an array of expert witnesses and continually reminded of the importance of chemicals to the financial health of the Delta, the jury took only a few minutes to exonerate the landlord, the tenant, and the aerial applicator. The Mississippi Supreme Court, however, on appeal, overturned the jury verdict and sent the case back for retrial in Sunflower County. And this is where the case was when I finished writing this talk. But yesterday I went to Drew and found out a little bit of the remaining a few pieces, as much as I could analyze it. And after several legal maneuvers, there was finally an outside of court. There was a settlement, a very small settlement. But I still have not found out how long Mr. Lawler survived because he was in extremely poor health. The Delta Council's call for expert testimony and the ARS memorandum were emblematic of the close ties between government scientists, lobbyists, and agribusiness. After World War II, the South quickly stepped onto the chemical treadmill. Along with mechanization, synthetic chemicals were seen as keys to the future of U.S. agriculture. Chemical companies competed to develop more effective pesticides and gain a share of the burgeoning market. During World War II, scientists had created chlorinated hydrocarbon poisons such as DDT, and German scientists had created organophosphates. As Edmund Russell has written in his recent book, War and Nature, poisons developed to kill insects and weeds were watered-down versions of formulas that were meant to kill people. By 1950, some dozen people had died from organophosphate poisoning, primarily due to ignoring the warning labels. As Russell wrote, the most dangerous organophosphate was parathion, which killed scores of farmers, crop dusters, and insecticide factory workers by 1957. The Chemical Corps used data from these cases to diagnose nerve gas exposure and treatment. Atropine was the chosen antidote to this poison. While DDT killed many kinds of insects, some were immune, and that's why you would follow up with organophosphates to kill the remaining insects that DDT didn't get. The close relations developed during World War II between government, entomologists, and industry blossomed in the post-war years. More effective chemicals not only changed agricultural methodology, but also the law. Even the most routine application of an herbicide could result in drift. When an airplane sprayed a field of rice for weeds, for example, the 2,4-D could drift over to the cotton crop and destroy it. Liability law expanded to assign responsibility for these problems. I have written earlier how in the 1950s, the Department of Agriculture scientists and administrators did not make public that both milk and beef, read baby food, contained residues, which under law none were permitted. That during the early fire ant spray campaigns, that the ARS denied that wildlife, fish, and livestock fell to the poison. And that, quote, experts showed up quickly after any report of pesticide poisoning to deny it. This was brought home to me yesterday in reading the deposition of a doctor from Glen Allen, Mississippi. She was not allowed to give this testimony in the trial. In the summer of 1957, they were spraying a mixture of Endrin and I think parathion in her community around Glen Allen. And she said that the number of black workers who came in with lung problems and coughing and what she diagnosed as chemical pneumonia went from something like, her caseload went from 50 to like 150. And she said people would lay out in the yard coughing and waiting to see her. And then she started getting sick because things were drifting into the office. And finally, she left Glen Allen and moved back, I think, to Jackson, as I remember this, and had to be hospitalized for several weeks to get her health back. So these are chilling things when you see these things unexpectedly. And I was going through some, again, in the National Archives last summer, going through some Agricultural Research Service papers, and found this 1969 research report that indicated, in the words of the report, 2,4-5-T administered by mouth or by injection in maximum tolerated doses to pregnant mice and rats may cause abnormal development of their embryos. The ARS recommended the cancellation of 2,4-5-T. And then a U.S. Department of Agriculture person realized that this would mean that the Department of Defense would have to stop using 2,4-5-T. He continued that for the Department of Defense to do so, and this is a quote, would be construed as tacit admission that DOC uses use of 245T in Vietnam has constituted a threat to all pregnant women in the areas of usage. I just read that and shook my head. I mean, these things are totally unexpected, but they're chilling. We started out with a broad idea that southern farms always contain problems. That reality is still being plumbed. There are historians like Lou Ann Jones, who's going to talk this afternoon, who's doing excellent work on southern farming, and there are a cadre of young people doing it. And I certainly encourage all their work. But we have a lot of work to do if we're ever to convince the implement companies, the lobbyists, and the congresspeople that the story of southern rural life is something that needs to be told in a major place like the National Museum of American History. I mean, I have dwelt a little bit on some things that aren't too pleasant here, but I was supposed to talk about reality, but there are other realities that we could talk about. Somewhere in the transformation of the rural South, there was contained a way for more people to live in harmony with the land, for bureaucracy to fade into the background, and for the application of far fewer chemicals. It may well be that it's too late to bring any sanity to the system, since we don't understand the system that runs agriculture. For example, several weeks ago, the New York Times reported on Congress's $171 billion 10-year farm bill, which you might recall follows the previous Freedom to Farm bill that would cut out subsidies. So $171 billion is a lot more than nothing. Reporter Elizabeth Becker observed how Congress, the White House, and the Department of Agriculture all used this Jeffersonian ideal to stake their claim. Everybody went back to Jefferson, although you can't find a trace of Jefferson's ideal out there in rural America anymore, a few traces. And one can imagine Mr. Jefferson himself thinking about $171 billion farm bill that contains the beauty of the Department of Agriculture is that it gives something to everybody. All these, they have these contradictory programs. You give money to this person, but this one over here might be offended, so you give this person something. And you tell these people to reduce over here and to grow over here. It's a magnificent system. Actually, if the United States system of agriculture since 1933 were to be located in a third world country that we were considering giving money to, we wouldn't give money until they had land reform. We would demand reform. What I finally just wanted to say was that a lot of our rural history is still hidden because the records are so voluminous. And I've spent years going through agricultural records in the National Archives and haven't even made a scratch. I mentioned that there were a lot of people doing work in agricultural history, but not enough. And what disturbs me finally is not just that so few historians are willing to do research and analysis, but that no one seems to care. Thank you.
Moments if Pete would be willing to entertain questions. Pete is you're asked the question, if you would please repeat it so okay. We can capture it. And if y'all, when you ask questions, could you please stand, that would help everyone here. With so many restrictions, does anyone have questions? Good Rob.
So many restrictions. What's your view of the sustainable agricultural movement?
I'm all for it. I really believe that we bought this chemical treadmill idea, and that maybe you better define sustainable agriculture movement for me.
Yeah.
My definition, Carolina Farm Stewards Association, which is not strictly and politically interested in anything but maintaining the ground for a safe environment for future agriculture. And again, it tries to avoid politics, things like that, but certainly wants to limit environmental impacts from chemicals, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm all for that. And as I mentioned, the gist of the paper is we bought into the idea that chemicals are the answer no matter what the question is. And as long as you do that, then there won't be any turning around except for the people who fight back. And I think there's a lot of people now who understand that if you don't farm these great fields that are like setting a big table for particular insects, and then you have to spray to do that, you get into this treadmill. But there are ways to farm that could be much where you use many fewer chemicals. Yes?
Looking back and defining what happened with the misuse of misinformation of chemicals, and looking forward with what's being presented now as a solution with genetically manipulated organisms as a solution, what's your take on that? Are we picking our poisons, or is that something that's hopeful in the future?
The question is, with genetic engineering offered now as the solution to all these things, are we facing a solution or are we facing additional problems? And my response is that we were told in the 1950s that these chemicals were benign, and we know now they weren't. We're told now that genetic engineering is benign. We don't know. We still don't know the damage that we suffered from chemicals in the 50s or now. These things like low-level radiation appear much later. And if it's 25 or 30 years and you're 50 or 60 years old and you come down with cancer, you don't know if it came from exposure to a chemical, from low-level radiation exposure, from having your teeth x-rayed. We don't know. So until some research is done on the long-term potential problems of genetic engineering, I think the least that we could have is food labeled so we can make the choice. I mean, we're eating genetically engineered food that we don't have a clue that that's what's happening. So that's the way I react to that. Yes.
What's your opinion of the land grant college system in Southern agriculture? Has it been generally positive or negative for American agriculture?
The question is, the land grant college system, has it been beneficial or negative? My evaluation of that, and that's a very tough question because, of course, I think land grant schools have done both. But they are, having said that, and I visit them often and I'm on good terms with people in these schools, but having said that, they are part of this system that encourages the use of machines and chemicals to achieve greater production. And that's their job. And of course, nobody's redefined that job to say, in detail, that what you should be doing is finding a way out of the chemical treadmill and finding a way to enable smaller farmers to survive. It's no secret that our agriculture is engineered by large interests at every stage, and the land-grant universities have an immense stake in keeping that going. Does that get to the question?
And yet, if we look at what we know today, the back of
I take that as a statement and not a question. Thank you. Yes. I don't think you'll ever get consumers to, the question is what, consumers need to be educated to the fact that they should pay more for food so farmers could make more money. But I've never met a consumer that wanted to pay more for something than they have to. So what we have is a system that gives us cheaper food at a very high cost in other areas. So... Yeah, but that price is, a lot of it's already been paid in the restructuring of agriculture. So there is a continuing price, but unless we were to have land reform, I don't think that it would make that much difference. I had a question in the very back. Yes. The question is, what can we individually do to influence policymakers on environmental issues? And the only thing I know to do is to meet like this and talk about it and let people know concerns. A lot of people don't ever think about the structure of agriculture. It's not the topic that you hear the talking heads going on about on television. And it's not something most people care about. So until we get committed to talk about potential problems with poisons and that kind of thing, I don't know that maybe somebody in the audience has a better idea. I'm frankly don't expect a lot of reform because the issue is not seen by most people as a crucial issue simply because you have so few cases of people being harmed by chemicals overtly. The damage is long-term. And I've talked to a good friend of mine who is vehemently against genetic engineering. And she says we have to educate people and so forth. And I said the only thing that will change public opinion is something very terrible to happen. And then people will say, why didn't we know this before? That's sad, but I think that's pretty much where we are.